From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Well, with respect, who made you the editor of Newsweek? Do you think it's appropriate for you at that podium, speaking with the authority of the President of the United States, to tell an American magazine what they should print?
I'm not telling them. I'm saying that we would encourage them to help.
Pressuring them.
No, I'm saying we would encourage them.
Pressure?
Look, this report caused serious damage to the image of the United States abroad. And Newsweek has said that they got it wrong. You know, I think Newsweek recognizes the responsibility they have.
The Newsweek controversy and the latest declassified documents that show the FBI knew of Quran desecration as early as 2002. Then a Bush appointee who's not in the limelight, Dr. W. David Hager. A Nation magazine article exposes claims by his ex-wife that he repeatedly raped her throughout their marriage.
Any man who abuses his wife this way should not be sitting on a federal board that regulates women's health, their sexuality.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Newly declassified documents released by the FBI have revealed detainees at Guantanamo Bay began complaining that the Quran was being desecrated by U.S. interrogators at the jail as early as 2002. The documents were obtained by the American Civil Liberties Union and include numerous summaries of FBI interviews with prisoners. One detainee interviewed in August of that year accused guards of flushing the Quran down the toilet. Others reported the Quran being kicked, withheld as punishment, and thrown on the floor. The news comes on the heels of the controversy over the Newsweek article by journalist Michael Isikoff saying government investigators had corroborated an almost identical incident. Newsweek ultimately retracted the story under intense pressure from the government. We'll have more on this in a few minutes. Meanwhile, in its annual report on human rights, Amnesty International has attacked the Bush administration for its mistreatment of detainees around the world. Amnesty's Secretary General, Irene Khan, described Guantanamo Bay as the, quote, gulag of our time, a reference to forced labor camps run by the former Soviet Union. Amnesty also criticized the Bush administration for failing to carry out a full and independent investigation of the torture at Abu Ghraib and for failing to hold any senior officials accountable. Khan went on to say, quote, the USA, as the unrivaled political, military, and economic hyperpower, sets the tone for governmental behavior worldwide. When the most powerful country in the world thumbs its nose at the rule of law and human rights, she said, it grants a license to others to commit abuse with impunity. The Wall Street Journal's editorial page responded by saying Amnesty's accusations amount, quote, to pro-Al-Qaeda propaganda. In other sections of its annual report, Amnesty said that Sudan has seen the worst human rights abuses over the past year. This is Amnesty International Secretary General Irene Khan.
In 2004, the most publicized case of inaction was Darfur. The government of Sudan betrayed the rights of its own people by launching a campaign of rape, killings, destruction, and displacement. But the UN also betrayed them by doing too little, too late. The people of Darfur were held hostage to China's oil interests, to Russia's arms trade, and to the U.S.'s aversion to the International Criminal Court.
That was Irene Khan of Amnesty International. In Iraq, the country's new defense minister has announced plans to deploy 40,000 Iraqi soldiers as part of a massive operation in Baghdad to fight the Iraqi resistance. It's expected to be by far the largest offensive waged against the resistance in Baghdad to date. The Iraqi government announced it plans to build a concrete blockade around the entire city in order to make it harder for resistance fighters to enter. On Capitol Hill, the House of Representatives has rejected a measure calling for President Bush to devise a plan to withdraw from Iraq. 128 members of the House supported the measure, but it was overwhelmingly defeated. It marked the first time Congress officially voted on withdrawing from Iraq. The motion was proposed by California Democrat Lynn Woolsey. She said, quote, it's time to give Iraq back to its own people. The Knight Ridder News Agency is reporting the U.S. military and Iraqi government are considering releasing up to 20 members of Saddam Hussein's former Ba'athist government. Included on the proposed list are three officials that once appeared on the Pentagon's 55 Most Wanted list. Two of the most prominent officials being considered for release are former oil minister Amar Rashid and his wife, the scientist Rahab Taha. She is best known in this country by the nickname Dr. Germ for her experiments with bacterial biological programs. Meanwhile, al-Qaeda has named a new acting chief in Iraq to temporarily replace Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who was reported to have been wounded in a recent attack. According to a statement posted on the internet, al-Qaeda has named Abu Hafs al-Qarni as its new leader in Iraq. U.S. officials have yet to confirm reports that Zarqawi was injured over the weekend after being shot in Ramadi. In Haiti, the country's ousted prime minister, Yvon Neptune, has appeared before a judge in connection with accusations he oversaw political killings last year. Neptune has been held for nearly a year without charge. He's been on a hunger strike for over a month to protest his imprisonment. The hearing was held behind closed doors. It's not clear whether Neptune was accompanied by a lawyer. A 1,000-mile oil pipeline that connects the Caspian Sea to the Mediterranean opened Wednesday. The Independent of London described it as the costliest and most significant pipeline ever built because it reshapes the geopolitical map of the Caspian region. The pipeline, which was built by a consortium led by BP, starts in the former Soviet state of Azerbaijan, passes through Georgia, ends in Turkey, right near the massive U.S. air base at Incirlik. The Asia Times reports the United States has been heavily involved in the planning of the pipeline over the past decade in an effort to secure a new source of oil outside the Persian Gulf and free of Russian influence. The newspaper points out that the most effective route of the pipeline would have been south through Iran or north through Russia, but instead it was designed to only go through nations with strong U.S. support. At a ceremony Wednesday, the U.S. Energy Secretary Samuel Bodman stood alongside the heads of state of Turkey, Georgia, and Azerbaijan. Bodman said, quote, "We view this as a significant step forward in the energy security of that region." The U.S. has spent millions to protect the underground pipeline. $64 million was sent to Georgia to train troops in anti-terrorism tactics, and the Bush administration plans to spend another $100 million to train and equip the Caspian Guard, a network of special operations and police units that will protect oil facilities and key assets in the region. Meanwhile, as the world focused on the new pipeline, the U.S.-backed government of Azerbaijan last week temporarily banned opposition parties from holding protest rallies demanding fair elections and free speech. In Egypt, anti-government protesters were beaten Wednesday during demonstrations calling for greater political reforms. The Los Angeles Times reported plain clothes and uniformed security officers helped and sometimes appeared to direct the attacks. The Washington Post reported riot police create corridors for stick-wielding men to freely charge the demonstrators. Women were specifically targeted. They were reportedly groped and had their clothes torn. Some demonstrators were thrown down flights of concrete stairs, dragged by their hair and kicked by swarms of young men. The attack on the protesters came just days after First Lady Laura Bush visited Egypt, where she praised Mubarak for what she described as very bold and wise moves toward reform. And on Capitol Hill, the full Senate has opened debate on John Bolton as ambassador to the United Nations. During the most dramatic moment of the debate, Republican Senator George Voinovich choked back tears as he pleaded with his colleagues not to vote for Bolton. And on Capitol Hill, the full Senate has opened debate once again on John Bolton. Voinovich, in his testimony, said, quote, "I don't want to take the risk. I came back here and ran for a second term because I'm worried about my kids and my grandchildren, and I just hope my colleagues will take the time and do some serious thinking about whether or not we should send John Bolton to the United Nations." We'll be right back. Baby, I Know What You're Thinking by the Mendoza Line here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Newly declassified documents released by the FBI reveal detainee claims of Quran desecration by U.S. guards at Guantanamo as early as 2002. The documents were obtained by the American Civil Liberties Union and include numerous summaries of FBI interviews with prisoners. One prisoner interviewed in August 2002 said guards had flushed the Quran in the toilet. Others reported the Quran being kicked, withheld as punishment, and thrown on the floor. The news comes on the heels of controversy over a Newsweek article by journalist Michael Isikoff that says the government investigators had corroborated an almost identical incident. Newsweek ultimately retracted its story under intense government pressure because a confidential government source could not be confirmed. After the story broke, the White House and Pentagon have painted Michael Isikoff and Newsweek as being responsible for deaths during rioting in Afghanistan following the article's publication. Pentagon spokesperson Larry Derrida said, quote, "People are dead because of what this son of a blank said. How could he be credible now?" Even after Newsweek retracted its story, the White House continued its offensive. This is White House spokesperson Scott McClellan last week.
Scott, you said that the retraction by Newsweek magazine of its story is a good first step. What else does the president want this American magazine to do?
Well, it's what I talked about yesterday. This report, which Newsweek has now retracted and said was wrong, has had serious consequences. People did lose their lives. The image of the United States abroad has been damaged. There is lasting damage to our image because of this report. And we would encourage Newsweek to do all that they can to help repair the damage that has been done, particularly in the region. And I think Newsweek can do that by talking about the way they got this wrong and pointing out what the policies and practices of the United States military are when it comes to the handling of the Holy Quran. The military put in place policies and procedures to make sure that the Quran was handled or is handled with the utmost care and respect. And I think it would help to point that out because some have taken this report, those that are opposed to the United States, some have taken this report and exploited it and used it to incite violence.
Well, with respect, who made you the editor of Newsweek? Do you think it's appropriate for you at that podium, speaking with the authority of the President of the United States, to tell an American magazine what they should print?
I'm not telling them. I'm saying that we would encourage them to help.
Pressuring them.
No, I'm saying we would encourage them. Pressure? Look, this report caused serious damage to the image of the United States abroad. And Newsweek has said that they got it wrong. You know, I think Newsweek recognizes the responsibility they have. We appreciate the step that they took by retracting the story. Now we would encourage them to move forward and do all that they can to help repair the damage that has been done by this report. And that's all I'm saying. But no, you're absolutely right. It's not my position to get into telling people what they can and cannot report.
White House spokesperson Scott McClellan at a news conference last week. Since then, media outlets and human rights groups have revealed scores of allegations of abuse of the Quran by U.S. interrogators and others. McClellan has now retreated on claims that Newsweek's retracted story cost lives in Afghanistan. This is from a White House news conference on Monday.
Karzai was quite definite in saying that he didn't believe that the violence in Afghanistan was directly tied to the Newsweek article about Quran desecration. From this podium, you have made that link. So,
Actually, I don't think you're actually characterizing what was said accurately.
By whom?
Now, as I said last week, and as President Karzai said today, as General Myers had said previously, the protests may well have been pre-staged. The discredited report was damaging. It was used to incite violence, but those who espouse an ideology of hatred and oppression and murder don't need an excuse to incite violence. But the reports from the region showed how this story was used to incite violence.
But Karzai seemed to think that wasn't what led to the violence.
He talked about, President Karzai spoke about how the demonstrations were aimed at undercutting the progress being made toward democracy in Afghanistan and the progress on elections. They have elections coming up soon, and I spoke about that as well last week.
So could it be said that the Newsweek article played a role but was not?
John, I think we've made our views known when it comes to the discredited report. There are some that want to continue to defend what is a discredited report that has been disavowed by Newsweek, and that's their business. We're perfectly willing to trust the American people to make their own judgment about it.
That was Scott McClellan, White House press spokesperson, joined now by Donna Lieberman, executive director of the New York chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's good to have you with us. We're going to talk about the Newsweek controversy in a minute and talk about which lies actually took lives over the last few years. But can you talk about the latest documents that have just been declassified from the FBI?
Yeah, the ACLU is getting thousands of pages every couple of weeks from the FBI, and the most recent batch of documents includes documents which are FBI interviews with detainees in which they accuse their jailers of beatings and a whole range of violence against them and of abusing the Quran. Included in those documents are complaints of throwing the Quran on the floor, withholding it, kicking it, and also flushing it down the toilet.
These documents have just come out.
These have just come out. The government releases them to us and to the press at the same time.
And who are the detainees who are saying this? Are these released detainees?
No. When you read the documents, it's revealing because if you remember when in the old days when people would ask for their FBI files and there were huge blank spots on the papers, well, it's just like that. And literally there are pages with just with everything whited out and just a couple of sentences. And these are documents created by the FBI, their internal memos on the interviews with the detainees while they're in custody. And they're revealing.
And who did they say was doing the desecration of the Quran?
Well, the desecration was done by the guards. We don't have names. Those are all blanked out. We don't have the names of the detainees who are making the complaints, but the internal FBI memos document time and time again that there are complaints of physical violence, which is beyond comprehension, and of religious abuse, and the kicking or flushing down the toilet of the Quran is just part of it. There are allegations, there are complaints here of the use of female guards by the United States to sexually abuse and harass the detainees as well, using their sexuality and what they believe it to be the Muslim views of sexuality and bodies to humiliate and intimidate and make it impossible for people to practice their religion as well.
Now, these are FBI documents.
Yes.
Are there others from other agencies?
Oh, absolutely. We have our Freedom of Information Act request, which has been going on for years now and which the government has resisted every way it possibly can. We have to go to court in order to get them to an order for the government to comply. We've gone after the documents at the Department of Defense, the CIA, and the FBI. The FBI is the only agency that has fully complied thus far, and the CIA is resisting big time. In fact, the case is on in court today. We've asked for, in addition to written verbal documents, we've asked for pictures and videos, and the CIA, you'll like this, claims that it can't release photographs because that would violate the Geneva Conventions, and it would compromise the privacy of the detainees.
And that's in court today.
That's in court today. Yes.
Donna Lieberman, executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union New York chapter, the New York Civil Liberties Union. When we come back, we'll continue to talk about the Newsweek controversy and talk about what this means for journalism today. Who's telling lies? When were they told? And when do the lies take lives? Stay with us. We'll be right back. Barn Owl by Caribou here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report, broadcasting on over 330 stations around the country, on Pacifica stations and affiliates, on low-power FM stations, on NPR stations, public access TV, PBS stations, and both TV satellite networks, DirecTV Channel 9, Channel 375, and on Dish Network Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and video and audio streaming at democracynow.org. Closed caption for people who are deaf and hard of hearing. And our new feature at democracynow.org is our headlines translated into Spanish. I'm Amy Goodman as we talk about the Newsweek controversy and the allegations of Quran abuse, the pressure from the U.S. government after Michael Isikoff's piece appeared. We're joined by Michael Massing, contributing editor of the Columbia Journalism Review, board member of the Committee to Protect Journalists, author of Now They Tell Us, The American Press in Iraq. And on the line from California, Norman Solomon, who is executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, author of the forthcoming book, War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. Well, Michael Massing, let's begin with you. Were you surprised as the Newsweek controversy started to unfold, the allegations of Quran desecration, and then what came next from the Pentagon, from the White House?
Well, no, it's part of a pattern that we've been seeing. You know, the press right now, I think a lot of journalists would feel they're under attack in ways that are unprecedented. And it's not just that you have, say, a president or a presidential press spokesman criticizing the press. You go back to President Kennedy and find that. But there's this echo chamber out there now that has really led to such a sort of forceful coming down on the media from a variety of places. So the White House is amplified by Fox News, by the Weekly Standard, by the Wall Street Journal editorial page. Now you have the blogs that, you know, instantaneously can ramp something up to a tremendous pressure. So we're seeing this as part of a pattern, much of it clearly calculated to put the press on the defensive and make it pull back in its reporting.
Can you talk about who was saying what at the same time that you had Lawrence Derrida talking about Michael Isikoff, talking about that son of a blank, and basically saying that there very much was blood on the hands of Newsweek. Talk about what else was being said by the government.
Well, General Richard Myers, head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said at a press conference, I actually looked up the press conference, and it came at the very end. He was with Donald Rumsfeld, and it was when the base closings was announced. And someone at the end asked about Newsweek's culpability, and General Myers was really very straightforward about this. He says, I have a general in the field, my representative in Afghanistan, and his feeling is that the Newsweek report is not at all the cause of what is happening there, that it is much more caught up in the local politics and anti-U.S. and anti-Karzai forces. And I went back and looked at how this got reported, and it came, if at all, at the end of several stories. So Derrida and McClellan, their comments were getting a tremendous amount of attention, and General Myers was buried at the end of articles. I think if that had been played up more earlier, that some of the statements now finally are coming around to that, as you just showed Scott McClellan saying.
It's pretty astounding. I mean, you have Lawrence Derrida, a Pentagon spokesperson, saying people are dead because of what the son of a blank said. How could he be credible now? And at the same time, he's saying the nature of where these things occurred, how quickly they occurred, the nature of individuals who are involved in it suggests they may be organized events that are using this alleged allegation as a pretext for activity that was already planned.
Right. And actually today on the op-ed page of the Times, Sarah Chase, who's been in Afghanistan for 3 years, former NPR correspondent, gets into more depth. I mean, I've actually been shocked at the lack of reporting on what's happened over there. I would assume we'd have more people like looking who were these organizers, what happened, just getting more information. And yet it's another case of how Afghanistan has been shoved aside because of Iraq. And so we're left in the dark.
Norman Solomon, your response for starters as this whole story unfolded.
Yeah, if we're going to raise the question of how can they be credible now, then we should be talking about the entire U.S. mass media and certainly the official sources that they relied on that got us into this war on Iraq in the first place. You know, one of the forms of deception is promotion of lies. The other is silence about key information. And we could ask now, who is dying today because of lies told through commission, through omission, silence about key information, and also we could demand who are today the news outlets that should be retracting both their deceptions before and during and after the invasion, as well as their silences. And if you go down that road, if you're going to go into what has been opened up by Scott McClellan and Lawrence DeRita and all those folks and raise the question of blood on their hands, then, you know, let's be clear. There's an enormous amount of blood on the hands of, if these major media institutions can be said to have hands, the New York Times, the Washington Post, major outlets that took on faith statements made by the White House, Pentagon, State Department, leading into and during this war to the present time, and people are dying. So it's a very much an indicator of the truncated and limited range of the mass media in this country, that these questions can be opened up and shut down at the same time. As it happens, we are speaking exactly 1 year ago today from the day May 26, 2004, when the New York Times, long after publishing these front-page articles about Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, printed a 14-page from the editor's note, finally acknowledging there was something wrong with their coverage. But even then, it was a semi-apology. We haven't had any sort of real dissection in the pages of the Times, or I would argue through the mass media in general, about how the Times and the Post and other major outlets played ball with, were part of the war propaganda system of this country that has resulted in this war.
Well, Michael Massing, it's what now they tell us the American press in Iraq is all about, and you specifically critique the New York Times. What about this? What people are held accountable for?
Well, it's an interesting thing because the press coverage goes in and out, and there are periods in which the press does better. And right now, I think most journalists look back on the period from the summer of 2002 when Dick Cheney makes the initial speech about Iraq to the beginning of the war as one of the great failures in American press coverage. I mean, led by the New York Times and the Washington Post and then everybody else falling into line. I mean, I think the press now sort of is aware of that. And I mean, you know, the New York Times, to its credit, ran that Tim Golden article in the face of the recent one about the abuses in Afghanistan. So they, you know, occasionally show there that they have some backbone. But I think that the period before the war really will go down as a textbook case of the press's failure to really play its role. And we are paying the cost now. There's no question.
And very briefly,
you know, I would argue that we're still paying the cost. And more importantly than that, people in Iraq and Afghanistan are paying the cost. You know, there's no accountability. The problem is we can say that the mass media of this country are aware of their failings in the lead into the war. But you have the same people running these institutions using the same sort of double standards and reliance on official sources that are winking at or ignoring certain stories that they don't want to play up because they're injurious to the U.S. government's position in terms of waging this so-called war on terror. And where is the accountability? What's being done to Newsweek for relatively minor journalistic transgressions is not being applied at all to those who are at the top of these major media institutions. They're getting off scot-free. Their reliance on official sources and trumpeting of these lines coming out of Washington continue unabated.
What about Newsweek's coverage? How would you assess it? We'll start with you, Norman Solomon.
Well, you know, there were minor problems with the sourcing, but I have to say, if you look at that sort of problem in comparison to the kind of coverage we've gotten and we failed to get from Newsweek and other outlets, it's quite striking. I mean, one irony is that almost 4 weeks before the invasion of Iraq began, Newsweek published an exclusive report. This was late February 2003. It was headlined The Defector's Secrets. It was a great piece by John Barry. It pointed out that Hussein Kamel, the son-in-law of Saddam Hussein, had told CIA and British intelligence officials in 1995 that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. This story was out there. I talked to John Barry 2 days after it ran. This was well before the war. If journalists had done their job across the board and looked into and talked about, reported on the implications of this exclusive from Newsweek, we might have been able to prevent this war instead of what did take place, because the silence was maintained by the mass media. It wasn't a story authenticated by the White House and the CIA, so they simply ignored it.
Michael Massing, your assessment of Newsweek.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I agree that Newsweek did before the war some very good pieces. They've also, I find the whole accusations of them being so anti-military now a bit ironic, because I've been looking now at the recent coverage, and if you look between the election in Iraq in late January and until the insurgent violence started again, the press basically was so pro-Bush, and Newsweek was among them. They have one article in which I've sort of clipped the one issue. In March, has a cover, the sort of the Arab Spring and Bush, how he deserves all the credit for this. They have this piece about Condi Rice. It goes back to sort of the old style of like building up a new figure, just the way they used to do with Don Rumsfeld. I mean, so for Newsweek, this one little Periscope item to be taken out and said, oh, this is an inherently anti-Bush organ, I think just doesn't hold up.
I'm looking at a piece in Salon.com by Juan Cole, who does Inform Comment, the blog, The Lies That Led to War. He says when Newsweek's source admitted he'd misidentified the government document in which he had seen an account of Quran desecration at Guantanamo, Pentagon spokesperson Lawrence DeRitt exploded, "People are dead because of what the son of a blank said. How could he be credible now?" DeRitt could have said the same things about his bosses in the Bush administration, Juan Cole writes. He says tens of thousands of people are dead in Iraq, including more than 1,600 U.S. soldiers and Marines, because of false allegations made by President George W. Bush and DeRitt's more immediate boss, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, about Saddam Hussein's non-existent weapons of mass destruction and equally imaginary active nuclear weapons program. And he goes on and then says, "We now know, thanks to a leaked British memo concerning the head of British intelligence, that the Bush administration, contrary to its explicit denials, had already made up its mind to attack Iraq and fix those bogus allegations to support its decision." In short, Bush and his top officials lied about Iraq. Michael Massey.
Yeah, I did want to bring up that the so-called Downing Street memo. Mark Danner, in the recent New York Review of Books, wrote about they actually published the memo, which no news organization, as far as I know, has done in full. And again, the U.S. media have not given any attention beyond a few inside stories to this, in some ways, the most explicit document yet about how they intentionally set out to manipulate the intelligence data to take the United States into the pre-declared aim of waging war. And again, where are our journalists and our editors? What do they think constitutes news that they would not put this on the front pages? And if it had been, I think it would have offered a great counterpoint to what they're now charging Newsweek with.
Yeah, you know, I'm sorry to say this is nothing new. It predates by decades and decades this administration and this war. You can go back to, for instance, how we got into bombing Yugoslavia viciously, major cities being bombed for 78 days. It was because not that secret memos weren't put on the front page or reported in the U.S. press, but public documents like the Rambouillet text that the U.S. government was pushing in early 1999, a text that explicitly demanded through Appendix B that essentially the government of Yugoslavia, of Slobodan Milosevic, turn over its country to NATO forces, U.S.-led NATO forces. This wasn't secret. It was on Democracy Now! The media watch group FAIR publicized it. The organization that I'm at, the Institute for Public Accuracy, put out news releases during the war about it. And yet we had the mass media refusing to publicize, you can go back in the archives, refusing to report the most basic facts about the ultimatum, the poison pill being put out by the Clinton administration to justify going to war that they wanted to pursue.
Michael Massing, your response.
Wow. I don't know. We could get into a whole debate about why the U.S. went to war in Kosovo. I actually think that, Was that based on lies, or was it based on terrible abuses being committed against Kosovars, Albanian Kosovars? So let's not go there, but I agree with the general.
Because it's about history. It's not just about this particular war. This was a document, I assume you would agree. The Rambouillet text should have been publicized. The American people had a right to know before that war what was being demanded of the Serbian government.
We have a huge history. I agree with you going back. I'm actually reading The Powers That Be right now. I'm going over it again, David Halberstam's great book, and the famous meeting that he describes in which President Kennedy meets with Arthur Oak Sulzberger, the publisher of The Times, in the White House, and Halberstam was then the only resident American reporter in Saigon, and he was already just antagonizing the powers that be. And Kennedy said to Sulzberger, don't you think your man in Saigon is getting too close to the story? And Sulzberger said, no, I don't. And then he said, don't you think he would be better off reporting from London or Paris? And Sulzberger said, no. And he was so shaken by this meeting. But in fact, Halberstam was supposed to take a leave. It was scheduled, and Sulzberger said, we're not going to have you go on leave because we don't want to be seen as backing down. And that type of attitude is one thing that I just find lacking now so much in our press. There's a need to push back. This is a calculated campaign to intimidate the media, and I would just like them to come out and say, I mean, Newsweek, I'd like them to say, okay, we got some things wrong, but you know what? This war is, we're going to keep pushing hard on it because there's so many things that need to be brought to the attention of the American people.
Finally, what did Newsweek get wrong?
I think that they went with one source on an item that, in fact, was not corroborated. And I think that they needed more sourcing on that before they went with it. We might actually find out more that even the specific thing they reported will have turned out to be right. But at the time, it seems to me that they did not have the nail it down properly.
And a tremendous amount of pressure might well have been brought on that source right after. And didn't they say they were talking about a government document that had these allegations of Quran abuse? We have not seen this Army report to know whether or not.
And in fact, what they retracted, I believe, was that the didn't know whether this was going to be in this investigative report. It wasn't whether these incidents had been taking place or not. So,
final comment, Norman Solomon.
Yeah, by the standard being applied today in the mass media to Newsweek, the entire hierarchy of the New York Times and the Washington Post, for starters, would resign. And instead of us arguing over whether a few people died as a result or none at all or whatever from the Newsweek Periscope item, we would be talking about tens of thousands, according to some biostatistics, up to hundred thousand or more in Iraq who have died as a result of the propaganda system that these editors willingly and I think knowingly for the most part lent themselves to.
Norman Solomon, his forthcoming book is War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. Also with us, Michael Massing, who wrote the book Now They Tell Us, The American Press and Iraq. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
لما قربت لعيونك ما لقيتوش لما قربت لعيونك ما لقيتوش لما قربت لعيونك ما لقيتوش Thank you.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Dr. W. David Hager was appointed by the Bush administration to the Reproductive Health Drugs Advisory Committee of the FDA, the Federal Drug Administration, in 2002. Dr. Hager is a prominent Kentucky-based obstetrician-gynecologist who is the author of 6 books, including Stress and the Woman's Body, and As Jesus Cared for Women. At the time, his appointment to the FDA Advisory Committee alarmed many women's groups because of his staunch opposition to abortion, emergency contraception, and premarital sex. In his writings, Dr. Hager has attacked the birth control pill for promoting promiscuity and advised Bible readings to relieve premenstrual syndrome. In December 2003, Dr. Hager was one of a small group of people on an FDA committee who voted against the over-the-counter sale of the morning-after pill, known as the emergency contraceptive pill. It's called Plan B. The vote was 23-4 in favor of permitting the pill to be sold without a prescription. One physician on the panel said Plan B, quote, is the safest product that we have seen brought before us. But the FDA took the unusual step of disregarding the committee's recommendation and didn't approve Plan B for over-the-counter sales. In an article on the cover of next week's Nation magazine, reporter Eilish McGarvey investigates Dr. Hager's role in persuading the FDA to reject Plan B. She also reveals allegations by Dr. Hager's former wife of rape and sexual abuse by Hager that went on for years. Dr. Hager's reappointment to the FDA committee is expected this June. McGarvey questions whether women would knowingly choose a sexual abuser as their gynecologist or be comfortable with the idea of letting one serve as a federal advisor on women's issues. Eilish McGarvey joins us from our Washington, D.C. studio. She wrote the piece in The Nation. Let's start with these allegations. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Eilish.
Thank you. Essentially, I spoke with Linda Carruth Davis, as she's now known, formerly Linda Hager, David Hager's wife of 32 years. I met her earlier this year, and she divorced Hager in 2002, right after he was appointed to the FDA committee. And she alleges that throughout the course of their 32-year-long marriage, he sexually abused her, culminating in the last 7 years in what could be described, if the allegations are accurate, under Kentucky law as first-degree sodomy, which is rape. Essentially, Linda Davis was narcoleptic, and David Hager would forcibly sodomize her in her while she slept. The pain of it would wake her up. Sometimes she would let him finish. Other times she would push him off. She would resist. Both of those situations and scenarios were confirmed to me by a high-level prosecutor in Lexington as being qualifying as rape in the first degree under Kentucky statutes. It should be noted, I think, that Linda Davis is actually a social conservative. She's a theological conservative. She didn't seek me out or seek the nation out as a venue for airing her grievances against her ex-husband. I had heard about her story anonymously through a friend of hers about a year ago, and it took me a year to convince the friend and to convince Linda Davis to tell me her story on the record. She was also a frequent collaborator with David Hager on his public speaking in the Christian medical arena, as well as a co-author on one of his books that you mentioned called Stress in the Woman's Body.
You open the Nation piece, which, by the way, did come out, by talking about Dr. Hager speaking before a packed auditorium at a small evangelical Christian school and his ex-wife being in the audience. Set the scene.
Sure. The school is called Asbury College. It's in Wilmore, Kentucky, in a small town near Lexington, Kentucky, where Dr. Hager was a physician, is a physician. And he was there to give a morning service in the chapel there. It is his alma mater. It is also Linda Davis's alma mater. They both have long legacies there. He's on the board of trustees. She was in the audience that day. This was October 2004, I think you mentioned, this past October. They were divorced. She was in the audience that day to hear her son give a vocal performance, and her ex-husband was scheduled to be the featured speaker. He rose to the podium and began talking about his role at the FDA, his role in the Plan B decision, which I think we'll possibly get to in a moment, and then also spoke publicly in this very sacred place that they both hold very dear in front of 1,000 people, and talked about publicly about their divorce and what a shock it was to him, what a blow, the fact that he really attributed the divorce to it being him not nourishing his marriage enough, nurturing his wife enough, and not giving her enough time, when in fact there had been a long legacy of sexual and emotional abuse that had finally forced her out of the marriage. I should also note that prior to the allegations of rape, in the earlier part of their marriage, David Hager had paid his wife for sex and had been extremely controlling of family finances, so that was a way that she could get money from him, as well as being pressuring her into things that she did not want to be doing, and really establishing a climate of sexual and emotional abuse throughout the marriage.
We're talking to Eilish McGarvey, whose piece in The Nation magazine is called Dr. Hager's Family Values. Is it possible, Eilish, that his ex-wife's politics have changed, and this is a political hit on her ex-husband?
Not at all. Actually, we've been tracking the fallout from the story. It's been out about a week now, very closely, and her main reason for going forward was to set the story straight. He had been very public in the aftermath of their divorce and speaking in front of that packed auditorium at Asbury, like we were talking about. That was actually a tipping point for her, that he had sought to publicly manage the perception of her as mentally unstable or promiscuous or things that were flatly untrue. And as his prominence was growing, his audience was widening for him to be able to do that, and she finally relented and decided that it was important to set the story straight and talk to me. But her politics haven't changed at all.
We did try to reach the FDA, and they said they wouldn't talk about individuals. But did you speak to Dr. Hager?
I did speak to Dr. Hager for 30 minutes in early April before the story went to press. And his only on-the-record quote to me was that he declined to comment. He subsequently, after the story was released, he spoke to the Lexington Herald Leader, his hometown newspaper, and essentially told them, I'm not going to get the quote exactly right here, but that they didn't have all the facts, and since they didn't have all the facts, that it wasn't true. But it was a very strange and kind of flimsy denial.
Eilish McGarvey has this piece in the May 30th issue called Dr. Hager's Family Values. We're also joined in our New York studio by Nancy Northup, the president of the Center for Reproductive Rights. The center's filed a lawsuit against the FDA. We're also joined by Sylvia Enriquez, executive director of the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health. Sylvia's organization is one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit. We did invite the FDA to come on the program, but they did not respond to our request. So, Nancy Northup, start off by talking about what this has to do with your lawsuit.
Well, we have sued the FDA over the failure to approve emergency contraception, that's often known as the morning after pill, for use on the drugstore shelves without a prescription. And the FDA's panel, including the panel Dr. Hager was on, overwhelmingly found that emergency contraception should be available off the counter shelves in a pharmacy. In a very unusual move, the FDA did not approve emergency contraception for over-the-counter use, and its own internal memos show that its scientists and the advisory committee all felt that it's safe and effective for over-the-counter use. So politics is going on in not approving emergency contraception. We've sued on behalf of the National Latina Institute, other women's groups who want to see this very safe method of contraception available.
And explain exactly what it is.
Emergency contraception is basically birth control pills that you can take within 72 hours of unprotected sex, or if contraception fails, as a backup plan. It will prevent pregnancy. And it's very effective if used within 72 hours and could help with the really high numbers of unintended pregnancies we have here in the United States.
Is this what we knew as RU486?
No, RU486 is actually an abortion pill, and that's taken a little bit later in pregnancy. This is contraception. It stops implantation and pregnancy from beginning. So it's contraception, and the American Medical Association and other women's health groups all believe this is important to be available on the drugstore shelves, instead of having to go to a doctor and get a prescription.
Sylvia Enriquez, why in particular the Latino Institute as the plaintiff here?
Well, as you may know, close to 40% of Latinas lack health insurance. Latinas have one of the highest rates of unintended pregnancies, and almost a quarter of Latinas lack any source of primary health care. Therefore, having emergency contraception available without a prescription and without having to necessarily go to a provider, especially when you've had unprotected sex, and it's a very timely manner, so you really need to get to be able to access emergency contraception immediately. So that's why we think it's critically important for Latinas and other women to be able to access emergency contraception in a timely manner.
And so what does this lawsuit mean? Where do you go from here?
Well, specifically, we are using it as another advocacy strategy to ensure that, you know, emergency contraception becomes available over the counter, and that science triumphs over politics in this situation.
What about Dr. Hager's role in this, Nancy Northup?
Well, Dr. Hager was one of the very few dissents on the advisory panel that told the FDA overwhelmingly, this is safe and effective. It meets all our standards for over-the-counter. So it's very troubling, particularly in the report in The Nation about Dr. Hager's comments in a church that, you know, God was sort of on his side in dissenting on this, that these kind of values are coming into play. The FDA should be making its decisions based on science, based on whether or not drugs are safe and effective and being able to use. The public health would so be promoted, which is part of the FDA's mission, by having emergency contraception available on drugstore shelves.
And how common is this kind of lawsuit that you have brought?
It is not usual at all, and that's because the FDA's actions here are highly unusual. When its own drug advisory panels want something over the counter, when its own scientists see something as safe and effective, and when it would so help advance the public health, the FDA makes those drugs available. So it's unusual because the actions here are very unusual.
What is the company that makes Plan B? And what role has it played?
The company that makes Plan B was originally called the Women's Capital Corporation, and it's now Bar Laboratories. They filed a petition in 2003 asking for its drug to be brought over-the-counter use. And they are still working with the FDA. The FDA's one of the comments it made in January was, boy, maybe this isn't going to be a good thing for young adolescent women. That's not supported by the drug studies. It's not supported by their inside scientists. But now the company has asked for this to be over-the-counter just for 16 and up. But our lawsuit is asking for this to be available for all women because it's safe and effective for all women. And there's no group, as its own scientists have said, that need it more than young women who are unlikely to go to a doctor to get a prescription.
Can you talk more, Sylvia Enriquez, about women's access to health care, particularly Latina women, in this climate? Is it different from Clinton to Bush?
Absolutely. We've seen that Latinas, because of, you know, the very hostile climate, but also not just on attacks on reproductive health care, but also on immigrant rights and civil rights, Latinas really lack access to basic healthcare services, let alone reproductive healthcare services. And when Latinas are, you know, confronted with an unintended pregnancy or the potential of an unintended pregnancy, we need to ensure that they have the most access to all sorts of healthcare, particularly emergency contraception. We've seen that, you know, Latinas have high rates of unintended pregnancy. Also, close to 70% of Latinas want more information on family planning, contraception, particularly emergency contraception. And this, you know, this method is very, very critical to ensure that the well-being of Latinas is met and that, you know, there are options for women to be able to make their own decisions and that their, you know, health and dignity is in their own hands.
What about the issue that abortion is now being raised for the first time, front page piece in the New York Times just a few days ago?
Well, the Supreme Court has taken another case on abortion, and it's one that involves young women's access to abortion in New Hampshire. And the court should, you know, has been pretty clear that young women do have a right to access contraception and abortion. The issue in New Hampshire is about a parental consent case. But we want to make sure, and in that case, I think the court will uphold what the lower court found, which is that women's health, including teenagers' health, always has to come first. And you have to make sure that they have a way to access health care. And that's what contraception is involved in women's health care, abortion is involved in women's health care. And that's the issue the Supreme Court's going to look at, whether New Hampshire didn't adequately provide for young women's health needs when they're trying to seek an abortion.
I want to wrap up with Eilish McGarvey on the issue of Dr. David Hager's personal life and about the allegations against him by his ex-wife and how this relates to Plan B and overall U.S. policy and women's access to health care.
Well, a couple of things. One thing that didn't get mentioned yet so far is that the second piece of news that was unearthed, besides these allegations of sexual abuse on behalf of Linda Davis, is that Dr. Hager has an explicit connection to the Plan B decision at the FDA that goes beyond just his dissent vote in the four that dissented in 2003. Dr. Hager in Asbury that day professed to having written what he deemed a minority opinion that someone at the FDA asked him to write in order to further clarify his views, which ended up being completely mirrored in the letter that the FDA sent to Barr Laboratories when it did not approve its over-the-counter status for Plan B. So this is a very serious thing. This is a matter of not just the committee vote standing on its own, but that the FDA actually solicited additional opinion outside of the committee process from a very highly politicized appointee like David Hager. And that point can't be lost. Hillary Clinton and Patty Murray in the Senate have actually stalled Lester Crawford's nomination to the FDA commissioner until Mike Leavitt at HHS has investigated the role that Hager played behind the scenes in the Plan B decision. It should also be said that there's a real amount of hypocrisy on the right here with the issue of Plan B. If, as you're seeing based on Hillary Clinton's comments earlier this year and some Democrats on the left, namely Howard Dean, talking about a desire to, while keep abortion safe and legal, also to reduce the abortion rate, Plan B is the way to do that. Many, many scientists have said that widening the availability of emergency contraception would reduce unintended pregnancies and thereby significantly reduce the American abortion rate. That should be something that should be a no-brainer, an easy thing for people on the left and the right to unify around. And yet you're seeing the Bush administration and religious conservatives going behind the scenes to make sure that Plan B is not accessible to women. There's some real, real questions and concerns that are raised by this.
Eilish, we only have 10 seconds, but why hasn't Linda Davis brought charges if she's making these charges so that David Hager can have his day in court?
I think she wants to save her family. I think this has been a hard enough thing to go through. She really wanted the truth to be out there. She doesn't want to destroy him, and she wants to start rebuilding a life with her adult sons.
Eilish McGarvey, author of the piece in May 30th edition of The Nation, Dr. Hager's Family Values. We've also been speaking with Nancy Northup, president of the Center for Reproductive Rights here in New York, and Silvia Enriquez, National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health. That does it for the broadcast. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Fabdo Kadush, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich, Jeremy Scahill, Nell Geiser, Maddie Harper. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.